Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, still glowing from busting through our $200,000 donation goal here. We're also moved, and thank you for the generosity and keeping the tradition of Iowa Public Radio going in such fine fashion. It is so moving to see all the contributions come in, and I just wanted to give a personal thanks to all of those who did. If you didn't get a chance, of course, you can always go to iowapublicradio.org to make your contribution. Well, later in the program, IPR's Katarina Sestarek will tell us about the lawsuit filed to block Iowa's new 24-hour abortion waiting period. Also claims that the Des Moines police violated protesters' free speech rights Monday night. Amy Mayer will be along, explaining a new study showing increasing nitrate levels in Iowa's drinking water. And toward the end of the hour, we'll meet IPR's newest reporter, Cassidy Arena. She'll tell us about her focus on Iowa's booming Latino population. But first of all, yesterday, state education officials released guidelines for public schools when they reopen for normal activities. The school opening guidance was posted on the department's website in preparation for the beginning of the school year, which for most schools occurs mid or late August. We've got a few weeks until then. IPR's Grant Gerlach is with me. He's been covering these developments in education. Hi, Grant.
Hi, Ben.
So you've been working, getting the latest reaction to these guidelines, even this morning. Let's have you sort of give us the highlights about these guidelines. What's the thrust of them?
Okay, yeah, so the state put out some recommendations, and there are several bullet points here. The ones that have been getting a lot of attention are, one is that masks should be allowed to be worn by students and teachers, but they should not be required. Also, screenings are not recommended for students and teachers arriving at school. It also states that schools cannot guarantee that students and teachers will observe social distancing at all times, especially when you look at buses. It does recommend schools teach hand washing and also teach students to be respectful toward people who are wearing masks or personal protective equipment. It also tells schools to provide personal protective equipment to staff and teachers who are at higher risk because they have to be in closer quarters or because they may have a health condition.
Mm-hmm. When I'm listening to those guidelines and sort of look at the spectrum from mild to very stringent recommendations there, this would be more toward the mild side, wouldn't it, Grant?
Well, yeah, I think the mask requirements, just saying that you can't require masks, I think is going to be controversial. Masks have become such a flashpoint and sort of a political part of how people are managing themselves during the pandemic, and now that debate is arriving at schools. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to have to weigh how they're going to handle this in their own policy. They don't have to follow the state guidelines. A lot of schools will, because this is what the state is setting out as its policy, but schools can choose to do something different on their own. But if they do, the state says, as part of these guidelines, that they should make it clear that they're departing from the state recommendations, and they're supposed to discuss things with their local public health officials before doing it.
Mm-hmm. So what reaction, in terms of specific reaction, have you had to these guidelines? Who have you been talking with?
I talked with a couple of superintendents this morning. For instance, Dr. Jane Lindemann, she's the superintendent in Waterloo, where they were planning on requiring both masks and symptom checks when school starts, in part because that's what they're doing now. Over the summer, in buildings where administrators and other staff have been working, they've been requiring people to wear masks in the hallways and when they might come into contact with one another. So they were planning on continuing that into the school year. They even spent $44,000 on masks so they would have some available for people who need them. She says that's still what they intend to do, but she's going to discuss it with local health officials just to make sure she understands what the rationale is for changing that. If they're going to not require masks, she wants to understand what the scientific basis would be to change that policy and go in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And so schools are sort of trying to thread this needle where they're trying to make people comfortable coming back to school to learn or to work. But people have all these different ideas of what they're comfortable with. So it's a difficult tightrope for those administrators to walk.
Right. And we can't blame people because there's been so many mixed, often contradictory messages about what should be done. We have 50 states with 50 different experiments, it's been said, in how to handle this coronavirus. But we also have the teachers. I see that the Iowa State Education Association, the teachers union, has reacted to this. Any more details there? Because, yeah, of course, some of these teachers are going to be in the higher risk categories, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. They said they're deeply disappointed with the state recommendations. The National Education Association has its own set of guidelines that is stronger. It includes mask wearing. And the Iowa State Education Association is urging school districts to act on their own to put stronger guidelines in place, including face coverings, physical distancing, and, you know, I should mention the CDC does weigh in on this. They have a list of considerations for schools to take, and it includes face coverings. They say face coverings should be worn by staff and students as feasible. That's how the CDC puts it. They also have a school readiness checklist, and that includes a recommendation for schools to develop a plan to conduct daily health checks of staff and students. So it does look like the CDC is recommending a little more action than the state is.
Mm-hmm. So when we contemplate, mid to late August, returning to school, it will be different than past school years for sure. But based on what you've gathered, Grant, what will it look like? We will have the universities have this hybrid of virtual and in-person classes. Will it more or less be the same in public schools in Iowa as well?
Yeah, so the schools are submitting their return to learn plans, and basically they all have a mix of basic plans that include fully face-to-face learning, a hybrid of in-person learning and virtual learning, and if it's necessary, a plan for fully virtual distance learning. When we were going through this in the spring, that was all voluntary, but now it's not. It's mandatory for students to participate whichever direction the school goes. And so those are the basics. But from there, I mean, how many school districts are there in Iowa? It'll be a little bit different everywhere you go. But
Right. Basically,
when you look in a classroom, schools are trying to keep kids apart as much as possible, spreading out the desks. In some places, they'll be putting up barriers between students who can't be far enough apart. And then they have to really think about how students are moving around the school. They'll be spreading out bathroom breaks. They'll be changing how class periods release in middle and high schools so students aren't all crowded together in the hallway. They'll be opening up new spaces for lunchrooms so that not everybody is crammed in the same cafeteria. So there are a lot of details for them to work out. And even though they're putting in these basic plans, they'll be working out these details, including masks and other measures that they want to take. They'll be working those things out over the next several weeks leading up to the beginning of school.
Right. And we haven't even really touched on school-related sports, have we? I mean, that's a whole other category.
Yeah, and that's opening up. The governor is opening up all school sports. So the plan is for those to go ahead. We've already seen complications with softball and baseball with athletes testing positive or related to someone who's tested positive and teams canceling games for a period of time.
Yep.
So it's going to be very, very start and stop as these things go, and schools will be adapting in as they go along too, making up, reacting to how things change. I know there's a lot of concern. I think they look around at some of the states that have reopened recently, like Texas and Florida, and the number of cases skyrocketing in those places. In Iowa, we haven't seen that jump in cases or hospitalizations, but there's just a lot of concern about what happens when the other shoe drops.
Right. Okay. IPR's Grant Gerlach, thanks for staying on top of this issue, Grant, education as it pertains to our pandemic. Grant Gerlach, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm looking at the totals, pandemic totals in Iowa from, this is yesterday, 10 a.m. to this morning, 10 a.m., 493 new cases, bringing us to a total of 27,555, seven new deaths, a total deaths now in Iowa surpassing 700 to 701. Currently, according to these statistics, 141 hospitalized, over 17,000 recovered. Let's talk briefly with Dr. Rosanna Rosa, an infectious disease specialist at Unity Point Health in Des Moines. Dr. Rosa, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for being with us. We have about 5 minutes. Let's jump through a number of things. You were just listening to Grant Gerlach there and these guidelines. What are your reactions to the state education officials' guidelines for community school districts?
Yes, I am really worried about a few issues actually with the guidelines in general. Referencing to the document that Grant was talking about with the CDC. CDC would actually classify this as the highest risk of reopening type of reopening because there's no assurance that there's going to be distancing and no face coverings. The document itself goes on to mention that. Teachers who are classified or workers that are at medium or high risk of exposure, according to OSHA's definition, will be provided PPE. And if one looks at OSHA's definition, teachers are medium risk of exposure because they need to come in relatively close contact with students. And so to that, you should add then the risk of severe illness that some of the teachers might have due to underlying existing conditions, medical conditions. So I think that PPE works. PPE has been shown to work in hospitals, but it also shows it's been shown to work in the community, and we should embrace it. I understand that wearing face masks might be uncomfortable, especially for children, but there are other PPE options, such as face shields, that would be more suitable for this type of learning spaces.
Mm-hmm. Face shields. I know they've been often talked. I use a face shield myself. They have certain advantages, don't they?
They do, and here at the University of Iowa, we have world-class epidemiologists, and they have been at the forefront of promoting the benefits of using face shields, and we should listen to our scientists. They work. This is face shields are widely used here in the hospital, and I think they have provided a great protection to us healthcare workers, and we should embrace them in the community as well.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Rosa, as we have this conversation here, I'm looking at a live feed of the White House's coronavirus task force addressing the nation for the first time in nearly 2 months. So zoom out a little bit outside of Iowa. What do you make of the spread, the breaking of records in some states for cases being reported in one day? Does this surprise you at all, considering that we've been across the country, including here in Iowa, reopening businesses and the economy?
Yeah, so I think that, certainly New York, the East, the Northeast was and the upper Northwest were truly the hot spots back in March and April. And now we are starting to see, because this is it's a big country, right? So we are now seeing those hot spots moving from place to place. And yes, they have been linked to reopening, right? There is this false sense of security, if things are business is up and running, it's a return to normal, when it should be interpreted as far from a return to normal for us. We should keep in mind that there were, and especially thinking about Iowa, right? We were seeing at the beginning of the pandemic these big numbers mostly associated with outbreaks at congregate settings, such as the meatpacking plants and long-term care facilities. And now the hotspots that we are seeing are those ones related to community spread, because perhaps you know, in the South and perhaps here in Iowa, we have forgotten that there can also be, what you know, community spread, widespread community transmission of the virus that can lead to large numbers of infections.
Right, and especially, we just have a few seconds left, especially because the CDC estimates there are so many cases that are asymptomatic, no symptoms, but you can be carrying and transmit the virus, right?
Yes, transmitting it to someone who may go on to get very sick or even die from this.
Mm-hmm. In 30 seconds, what do you see in the future, Dr. Rosa? Potential lockdowns again, shelter in place orders again necessary?
I think if we don't embrace PPE in the community, we are going to end up in that situation. Back in March, we didn't know how well face coverings work. We know how it's not a political statement. It's a statement that you care about your community. If you don't want to go on a lockdown, then please wear a face covering.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for joining us with your expertise. Dr. Rosana Rosa, infectious disease specialist at Unity Point Health in Des Moines. We appreciate your time, Dr. Rosana Rosa. Take care.
Thank you very much. Anytime.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this week, Planned Parenthood and the ACLU of Iowa filed a lawsuit seeking to block a 24-hour abortion waiting period from being enforced in Iowa. Katerina Sestarek joins me now, IPR's state government reporter. Hi, Katerina. This is one of the stories we want to talk with you briefly today about. Tell us about this legislation. This was really done in those hurried final hours of the legislative session, wasn't it?
Yeah, this was something that was done on the last night of the legislative session, and it was kind of introduced quickly and without a chance for public comment, and that's actually one of the things that this law is challenging. It's challenging both the 24-hour waiting period, saying that it's unconstitutional, and also challenging the way in which it was passed, which, like you said, was in the final hours. It was something that hadn't been proposed earlier in the session at all. So it's something that the public never got a chance to comment on like it usually does with other legislation.
Mm-hmm. And talk a little bit about how this references or at least relates to the Iowa Supreme Court ruling back in 2018 had a similar waiting period, longer, I think, right? But the court struck that down.
Right. The Iowa Supreme Court struck down a 72-hour waiting period in 2018. And in that decision, they wrote that abortion rights have very strong fundamental right protections in Iowa under the Iowa Constitution. And so this is something that a lot of Republicans and anti-abortion activists really were upset with that ruling. And first, they wanted a constitutional amendment that would essentially undo that ruling, but that wasn't able to pass. The House wasn't able to pass that this year in the legislative session. So they instead came up with this 24-hour abortion waiting period, which they hope now that, you know, Planned Parenthood and the ACLU are suing over it. They hope that this is something that can go all the way up to the Iowa Supreme Court, which now has a very different makeup, with four justices having been appointed recently by Governor Kim Reynolds, Republican Governor Kim Reynolds. They hope that, that ruling can get eroded or overturned or something like that. I asked about that issue, and the ACLU of Iowa's legal director said that, you know, they believe that Iowa has a strong independent court system and that they will follow the binding precedent of that 2018 ruling, which they say would require the court to strike down the 24-hour abortion waiting period as well.
Mm-hmm. How much of this is done by the anti-abortion activists here with an eye towards what the U.S. Supreme Court is doing and the perhaps future change in the makeup of that court?
Conservatives are hoping that the U.S. Supreme Court overturned or erodes the Roe v. Wade decision from the 70s that legalized abortion in the whole country. Right now, with that 2018 Iowa Supreme Court decision that I was talking about earlier, even if Roe v. Wade was overturned at the federal level, abortion rights would still have strong protections in Iowa because of that Iowa Supreme Court ruling. If the Iowa Supreme Court ruling on abortion was overturned or undermined in some way, an overturn of Roe v. Wade at the federal level could then affect Iowans' abortion rights as well. And so that's something that I think anti-abortion activists in Iowa are very aware of, and that's part of the reason that they're trying to get this Iowa Supreme Court ruling overturned.
Mm-hmm. Katerina, I wanted to ask you about another news story you've been covering this week. Also, the ACLU of Iowa involved with this, a police action Monday night in Des Moines. First of all, tell us what happened Monday night.
Well, I wasn't there, but protesters are saying that law enforcement, which included the Des Moines Police Department and the Iowa State Patrol, essentially pushed them away from their planned protest route into a residential area, boxed them in, and then ordered them to leave. But the protesters are saying because the police blocked them in, they were trying to follow that order and couldn't. And then 18 protesters were arrested for failure to disperse, for failing to leave the area. They're also alleging that there was the police were using pepper spray and pushing protesters with shields. And so Des Moines Police Department and the Iowa State Patrol provided statements saying that the protesters always had an avenue to prove themselves and that they were given enough time to follow the dispersal orders. But the activists are accusing them of lying about that. And they're saying that they, didn't do anything wrong. They weren't doing anything. They weren't causing any property damage. They're saying they weren't, doing anything that would warrant that kind of treatment.
Mm-hmm. So where does that stand now? Is there going to be a follow-up? Is there anything to watch here?
Well, ACLU of Iowa said, they heard these accounts from the protesters. They're calling them and other witnesses. They're saying these are credible accounts about the protesters being boxed and about police using excessive force on nonviolent protesters. And they're kind of saying they're considering, a potential lawsuit over this action.
Okay. Katerina Sestarek, IPR state government reporter. Thanks for the update, Katerina.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, Amy Mayer explains a new study showing increasing nitrate levels in Iowa's drinking water. Also, we meet IPR's newest reporter, Cassidy Arena. We'll learn about her focus on Iowa's booming Latino population. And of course, because it's Friday, we get to groove into the weekend. Mark Simmet of IPR's Studio One will be here to share a couple of tracks easing us into the weekend. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, a new analysis of drinking water systems shows communities in five Midwest states, including Iowa, have legal but potentially worrying levels of nitrates. Let's get details from Amy Mayer, a reporter for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
Before we get to the report, remind us, what are nitrates? Where do they come from?
In Midwest drinking water systems, one of the major sources of nitrates is runoff from farm fields. When farmers fertilize their fields with nitrogen, that nitrogen, is supposed to be taken up by the roots of the plants. That's why it's there. When there's more than the plants can take up, or when there's heavy rains before the plants can take it up, that washes down into waterways, and chemical processes happen. So we call it nitrogen when it's put on the field. These chemical processes happen, and then what can be residual and wind up in drinking water is the nitrate, and that has potential human health concerns if we drink the nitrate.
Okay, I want to ask you about those health concerns in more detail in a moment, but first of all, let's get to this new analysis. What does it show in five Midwest states?
The Environmental Working Group looked at publicly available drinking water system data. They actually looked at 10 states overall, but in particular in the Midwest, they looked at Iowa, Illinois, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Nebraska. And what they found is that in all of the states, there has been an increase in the concerning levels of nitrates in many drinking water systems. The results are a little bit different from state to state, and in particular, one thing that struck me looking at it is that in Kansas, Illinois, and Iowa, there was a certain year where you just saw a really dramatic increase, small in quantity. So we're not talking about like suddenly the water was poisonous, but you know, a pretty significant spike in the graph, and that's likely because of heavy rain events. When those happen, again, that process of these fertilizer nutrients washing away can happen. So that can cause a spike. Those spikes were rare, but overall, when you look at the trends, Nebraska seems to be slowing the increase of nitrates in their drinking water systems, talking generally about the state overall, which is a little bit more success than some of the other states have had. But in all of the states, this remains a concern.
Okay, let's dig a little deeper into the health hazard here. What do they do to humans, to us, when we drink, when we have levels in our drinking water that are deemed too much?
Back in the 60s, the original research that raised alarm bells about nitrates in drinking water correlated it with blue baby syndrome, which is a condition that essentially asphyxiates the baby, denying oxygen to the brain, as I understand it. So the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, set a limit of 10 milligrams per liter. Below that, they felt it was not going to be a risk for this blue baby syndrome. More recently, there's been additional research looking at whether other conditions might also be correlated with elevated levels of nitrates. And there is now some research showing that certain cancers, including colorectal cancers, may be correlated, as well as thyroid disease and also neural tube defects, which is a birth defect. So the Environmental Working Group was particularly interested in looking at below the regulatory threshold, which is that 10 milligrams per liter. Below that, are there other exposure levels that could also be concerning for the public health? And because this research suggested there could be, the Environmental Working Group wanted to know when are we seeing levels of that. So the EPA says 3 milligrams per liter is naturally occurring. So the Environmental Working Group research really looked at between 3 and 10 what's going on there. And that's where we saw several of these states are having a hard time keeping it, you know, well below 10 instead of just below 10, which most of them are achieving just below 10.
I see. That's where we'll still have these legal limits. We're still below those, but it's still above what we would like it to be. So who should be concerned? Because we here in Iowa, depending on where we are, we get our waters from groundwater, we get it from river water, from wells. Who should be concerned?
There's a couple of different areas where one might be concerned. So if you are someone who's primarily concerned about, is there going to be a public health problem in my drinking water, that could be people who might have concerns about, you know, newborns or people who might already be predisposed to some cancers. I could see potential concern there. But because the water systems are obligated to provide clean, healthy water, the different concern would be, what's this going to cost? What is it going to cost us to keep our water clean or to make it clean if it's not? And in that sense, the biggest concern should be among residents of smaller communities that are operating their own water utilities, because the biggest systems, like the Des Moines Water Works, have put in really expensive infrastructure so that it's available to them to provide treatment to get the nitrates out before the water goes out to households. In smaller communities, that's a much more expensive proposition on a per capita basis.
And this ties into that lawsuit of a few years ago, right, in the Des Moines Water Works.
Right, sure. The Des Moines Water Works was trying to figure out if they could hold others responsible, people upriver responsible for the expense they were undertaking to clean out the water. Right, and that drew a lot of attention to the issue in a lot of communities. But for smaller communities, the proposition of putting in a nitrate removal system is just prohibitively expensive. They've got to find other ways to have their water be cleaner.
And for people in communities, whatever community they are, you can find out the water quality that's being provided by your community. It's publicly available information, or should be. That's what people should do if they want to ask about it and find out the nitrate levels in their own community, right?
Absolutely. You should actually receive that information from your water utility. I think they're supposed to provide it at least once a year, but if you don't have it or you can't find it, certainly the website of your water utility or a phone call to them, it's something they could provide. Also, that information is aggregated by state departments of natural resources, and that's where the Environmental Working Group got most of their data. So the Iowa DNR will have data on tap water for all of the municipalities that are providing it.
Of course, if you're taking water from your own well, you have to take responsibility yourself for everything, for testing and finding out if it's safe, right?
That's right. And that's an area that some other people have done some explorations in to see whether homeowners with well water are actually aware that they ought to be testing and know how to get that testing and so forth.
Mm-hmm. This is encouraging, though. You see in these states, you mentioned Nebraska, I think Hastings, Nebraska, in your reporting, that Nebraska is doing what, better than Iowa at preventing nitrates from getting in the water and removing them?
I don't know if we really want to say better than, because we probably could find lots of different ways to look at the statistics and draw different conclusions. But the thing about Hastings, Nebraska, is that what they've done is found a way to essentially filter water coming into the system. It involves old wells and knowing where the nitrates are likely to flow from and what the flow rate is, et cetera. But it was a much cheaper system to put in place that allows filtration to happen, and then clean water is what gets injected back into the aquifer so that what the wells that provide drinking water are actually drawing from is clean already. So providing this filtration on the front end turned out to be a whole lot cheaper than trying to remove nitrates after the fact, once that water was supposed to be drinking water but yet couldn't be because of the pollution.
Mm-hmm. So a creative solution from Hastings, Nebraska. Interesting. Perhaps something Iowa communities can emulate. Amy Mayer, fascinating. And thank you for getting us up to speed on this new analysis of drinking water, showing communities in 5 Midwest states, Iowa included, having legal, but potentially worrying levels of nitrates. So something to focus on. Probably, Amy, something that will catch, I would assume, lawmakers' attention here in Iowa, right?
I suspect we'll hear more about this, yes. Certainly water quality is on everybody's minds.
Okay, Amy Mayer, reporter for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Until next time, Amy, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, you've probably noticed a new voice in our reporting ranks over the past few weeks. We're overjoyed to have Cassidy Arena join our news team. She's been with IPR since June 1st, and she comes to us as part of the Report for America Newsroom project. Let's take a few minutes to get to know Cassidy and what she's focusing on here at IPR. Cassidy Arena, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's have you start off by introducing yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and your background.
Well, I'm Cassidy Arena. I actually grew up in Iowa's backyard in Omaha, Nebraska. So I'm familiar with a lot of Iowa happenings, considering Council Bluffs is right in my backyard. And I just recently graduated from the University of Missouri in Columbia from the School of Journalism with a focus on radio reporting and producing. And to be honest, Iowa was my number one choice when it came to careers right after college. So I feel pretty fortunate to be here.
Uh-huh. We all understand why Iowa would be a number one choice. But for you growing up in Omaha, tell us why Iowa was such a big attraction for you in public radio.
So growing up in Nebraska, it is a Midwest state, but there isn't a lot going on there, at least not on a national scale. So for me, looking at Iowa, it was so attractive because it really combined the Midwestern values that I grew up to know and love, and then also that national scale of news, politics, economy, agriculture. So it was a great combination of everything I was interested in.
Hmm. So tell us about the project you're part of. It's a special project called Report for America Newsroom Project. Tell us what that's about.
Report for America, for those who haven't heard about it, is pretty similar to the Peace Corps, which in the sense that they take emerging journalists and place us in newsrooms across the country to report on undercovered issues. So my issue, or my community that I focus on with Iowa Public Radio, is the Latino and Spanish-speaking community here, which is growing fast, and there's a lot going on, so I am not in need for news. There's so many things that I am excited to cover.
Mm-hmm. And you have a Latino background yourself?
I do. My family is from Cuba, so I grew up with the Spanish language always around, and whether it was going to my bisabuela or my great-grandmother's home and listening to telenovelas in the background, or just hearing my grandparents talk about people behind their backs in front of their faces.
That's always a good use for a second language in a family.
Yes.
Tell us, in your short time you've been here in Iowa, what interests you most about the Latino community here in Iowa? And we have some very interesting communities with Latino populations.
Yes. So something that I found out pretty quickly right away, Report for America kept saying, this is a small community you're covering. It's so minimal compared to the rest of the Iowa population. I have actually found that to be untrue. I've met so many interesting people with so many interesting stories that maybe are harder to report on if their first language isn't English. So for me, it's been almost a privilege to amplify these voices right here in Iowa that maybe haven't been heard before. I always like to say that as a journalist, I'm not speaking for you. I'm providing you with a platform for your voice to be heard, and not to be cliche.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when you get in contact with these people and more in the coming weeks and months, for instance, in West Liberty, this is where the Latino residents are more than 20% of the population. It's Iowa's first majority-minority community, and I imagine, you know, these people, we know they've been underserved in terms of Iowa Public Radio, and so when they come and meet you and say, hey, I'm dedicated to, in part, to covering issues of the Latino community here in Iowa, that must be, you must get a good reception.
Well, it's a good reception, but I'll also say it's pretty humbling to be in the position to help out these people with real issues and kind of meet them at their level. So it's, again, it's surprisingly humbling to listen to these stories that haven't been covered before, and communities are looking to be heard. So if I can be a vehicle to help their issues come to light for everybody else to hear, it's a pretty big responsibility, but it's one that I truly enjoy.
Mm-hmm. So what are some specific issues, given that goal, that mission here in Iowa, what are some specific issues you're looking at, planning to cover in the coming days and weeks?
I think especially during this time, not only of global pandemic, where the Latino and Black and Brown communities are disproportionately affected. That is one main thing that I am focusing on, but also during a time of when we're seeing a lot of racial injustice, and which is right now the focus is on the Black community, but it's also pretty prevalent in the Latino community. So there's a lot of injustice going on right now, a lot of uncertainties going on right now with these communities. So that's going to take a little bit more of an investigation on my part as well to help them make sure that everybody else in Iowa knows what's going on, kind of in their closets.
Right, right. So Cassidy, it's been a real pleasure getting to know you a little bit, and we look forward to your reporting in the coming weeks and months. And you've lived in Iowa now just for a few weeks. I have to ask, it's a pretty amazing time to be moving, putting down roots in a new place. What do you think of Iowa?
Well, considering I grew up in Nebraska, it really isn't that far distance-wise. But I will say, even though I moved during a pandemic and during some social unrest, people have been extraordinarily friendly. I haven't been able to go anywhere without somebody saying good morning. I walk my dog every morning, and people always smile and meet my gaze eye to eye. So that's just been, I know that it's super cliche to say that Midwestern people are nice, but it's
they
true.
They don't do that in Omaha?
Not as much, I will say.
Not as much. Interesting. All right. Cassidy Arena, well, I'm glad you're getting a great welcome here in Iowa. We welcome you and look forward to all your reporting. Iowa Public Radio's newest reporter, part of the Report for America Newsroom Project. As she said, sort of a Peace Corps for journalists, Report for America Newsroom Project. Cassidy Arena, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's finish up this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News by grooving into the weekend, of course. Mark Simmet is with us from IPR's Studio One. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Ben.
Took a quick listen to the tracks you have ready for us. A fun couple of tunes. Let's get right to the first one. What do you have?
Yeah, well, let's call this your feel-good song of the day. It's from a band called Tijuana Panthers. They're from Long Beach, California, kind of a surf rock band. And this song has to do with bike riding. I know you're a biker, Ben, so
yes.
Kind of had you in mind for this
Thank
one.
Thank you.
You know, you like to finish the week on an up note, so here we go. This one's called Heaven, Ride My Bike to the Land of Love.
Love those lyrics, Mark. Wish I could ride my bike to the land of love. You're reading my mind with these tracks, Mark, and on such an up note, because we reached and really went through the ceiling in terms of our goal for our 2.5-day fun drive. So it's reason enough for more celebratory music. Have you got another one, Mark?
I agree. This is from the band X, formed in Los Angeles in 1977, part of the punk scene of that day, but actually a lot more going on with X than simply punk music. They broke up eventually, reunited in the early 2000s, and it's their first studio album in 27 years. And they have one of the songs on here is actually a remake of a track they did earlier on in their career, and it's called Cyrano de Bergerac's Back.
To say for all your stone and silent types, don't talk to the girls they want to love, though it means a lie. I'll say this next time you get stuck and the words won't come, your eyes are blue. Just
So X with Cyrano de Burgers back. Nice play on words there, Mark. We'll go out with this tune. Thank you very much. Mark Simmet, get your daily soundtrack from Mark, Cece, and Tony. 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock, the best new music and old favorites. Thanks, Mark. Have a great weekend.
You too, Ben. Thanks.
River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great tunes into the weekend. Wishing you a wonderful weekend. And we are riding high, thanking you Iowa Public Radio listeners who donated and took us over the top through our $200,000 goal in just 2.5 days. Thank you so much. We'll be here for you for as long as you continue to support us. Take care. Have a great weekend.